All right, everyone, let's get the show started. Welcome to Office Hours. It's February 19th, 2020. My name is Eric Osterman, and I'll be leading the conversation. I'm the CEO and founder of Cloud Posse. We are a DevOps accelerator. We help startups own their infrastructure in record time by building it for you and then showing you the ropes. For those of you new to the call, the format is very informal. My goal is to get your questions answered. So feel free to unmute yourself at any time if you want to jump in and participate. If you're tuning in from our podcast or YouTube channel, you can register for these live and interactive sessions by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. We host these calls every week. We automatically post a recording of this session to the Office Hours channel, as well as follow up with an email so you can share it with your team. If you want to share something in private, just ask and we can temporarily suspend the recording. With that said, let's kick it off. So I got a couple of talking points lined up here today, if there aren't any other questions. First, some practical recommendations for 12-factor apps on Kubernetes. It's a checklist I put together because it comes up time and time again when we're working with customers. So I want to share that with you guys, get your feedback. Did I miss anything? Is anything unclear? It'd be helpful. Also, John on the call has a demo, a nice little productivity hack for multi-line editing in VS Code. I've already seen it. It's pretty sweet, so I want to make sure you all have that in your back pocket. Also, Zach shared an interesting thing today I hadn't seen before, but it's been around for a little while. It's called Goldilocks, and it's a clever way of figuring out how to right-size your Kubernetes pod, so we'll talk about that a little bit. And always on the list, but we never seem to get to it, our DevOps interview questions. So yeah, if conversation runs dry, we'll cover that as well. All right, so before we get into any of these talking points, I just want to go over any or cover any of your questions that you might have using Cloud Posse technology or just in general related to DevOps.
I got a question.
All right.
Fire away. In a scenario where you have multiple clusters and you may not be using the same versions across these things, like say in a scenario where you may be actually managing for clients, how do you deal with the versions of kubectl, being able to switch between the cluster versions and so on? If there's any strategies out there that we can actually utilize?
I'm happy to help answer that. Before I do, anybody have any tips on how they do it? All right. So what we've been doing, because this has come up recently, specifically for that use case that you have. So I know, Dale, you are already very familiar with Geodesic and what we do with that. And that solves one kind of problem, but it doesn't solve all the problems. So, for example, like you said, you need different versions of kubectl. Well, so kubectl, I want to talk about one specific nuance about that. And that is that kubectl is designed to be backwards compatible with, I believe, the last three minor releases or something. So there's generally no harm in at least keeping it upgraded or updated. But that might not still be the answer you're looking for, the thing you want to do. I know we had to address this situation separately. So that's why what we do is under Cloud Posse packages, so this is github.com/cloudposse/packages, we distribute a few versions of kubectl pinned at a few minor releases. Now, I think we only have the latest three versions because we only started doing this relatively recently. But the nuance of what we're doing with our packages is using the alternative system that I believe Debian originally came up with, and it's also supported on Alpine. So basically what you can do is you can install all three versions of a package, and then you point the alternative to the version that you want to use to run those commands. So that's one option. And that requires a little bit of familiarity with the alternative systems and how to switch between them. I think there's actually a menu now that you can choose which one you want. But the other option, which we use for Terraform, is where you will want to have a bunch of 0.11 compatible projects and some 0.12 compatible projects, and you want to have, you don't want to be switching between alternatives to run them. So what we did there was we actually installed them into two different paths on the system. So like user local Terraform 0.11 bin, and that's where we stick the Terraform binary for that. And then user local Terraform /0.12/bin/Terraform, and that would be the binary there. So just by changing the search path based on your working directory or where you're at, you can use that the version of Terraform you want without changing any make files, without changing any tooling like that that expects it just to be Terraform in your search path. I can dive into either one of those explanations more if you want to see more details on that. Is that along the lines of what you're looking for, or are you looking for something else?
So there's a tool I came across before I really got into geodesic, which was called TF Switch. That happens like Terraform, where you can actually switch between the versions that you need.
Yeah.
I was hoping that there was something that I hadn't found that was similar to that. I would do a kubectl switch.
Gotcha. Yeah, there could be. Is it Arat? I think it's you. You have a thing for Terraform also you're working on. Yeah. Now, I know your question, Dale, was related to kubectl. But just speaking for me personally, I don't like the end switchers, like the RBMs of the world, the TFM, like the TF version managers and stuff like that for us. But obviously, it's a very popular pattern, so somebody else is probably a better answer after that one.
All right, cool.
So one other idea on that, or let me just clarify, the reason why I haven't been fond of the version managers for software, of the purpose-built version managers, like that you need an RBM for Ruby or whatever, and then you need a TerraformM for Terraform, and then you need a one for kubectl and all these things. What I don't like about it is, where does the madness stop? Like, we technically need to be versioning all of this stuff, and that's why I don't like those solutions. That's why I like the alternative system, because it's built into how the OS package management system works.
Do you foresee taking that similar approach for Terraform and that version switching with, say, kubectl in the future?
I kind of glossed over it or hand-waved. So if I go to GitHub Cloud Posse packages, now I don't know if you're using Alpine, and Alpine has become a little bit less popular lately with all the bad press about performance. So let's see here. So if we go into the vendor folder here, so we literally have a package for kubectl 1.13, 1.14, 1.15. So we will continue doing that for other versions. And the way it works with alternatives is basically this. And you don't have to use Alpine to do this. This is supported on the other OS distributions too. But you install the alternatives system, and then when you have that, you can switch. So this here shows how to set up the alternatives that you have. Then there's another command you use to select between the versions available. And once you've installed all the versions, it's very easy to select between those. I just don't remember what it is off the top of my head.
I think it's like a fuzzy thing.
Yeah, I think it uses FCF or whatever that tool is. Yeah.
Are you meaning to share your screen, Eric?
I was. Thank you. Thank you, guys. Public service announcement. I always forget to share my screen, and I talk and hand wave and point to things like I am. So, yeah, so this is, so here in Cloud Posse packages, under vendor, we have, all our packages. Here's where we distribute the minor pinned versions of kubectl. And then we also do the same thing like for Terraform.
Nice.
Right. All right. Good question. Anybody else have anything to add to that?
I have one more if no one else is going to ask.
Just related to that, it reminded me, but it doesn't look like Andrew Roth. Is he on the call? This conversation, because Andrew has a similar tool to Geodesic that he's calling Dad's Garage, And the conversation was, so if you look in, I forget what channel it was, release engineering, I think. If you look in the release engineering channel, those are similar conversations. All right, yeah, next question, Dale.
So has anyone actually successfully done any multi-architecture builds for Docker?
Say that one more time, multi-architecture builds?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, interesting. So you're saying like Docker for, Docker for ARM and Docker for AMD 64 or something?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, I'd be curious about that. No personal experience.
Yeah, I've been trying to do something, do that kind of build for my Raspberry Pi cluster.
I was going to say, is this for your Raspberry Pi Kubernetes cluster?
Yeah. So I figured, this is probably public-9, but I just came across it where I'm running into issues with my Raspberry Pi 3 B+, where it's using ARM v7, and a lot of the packages that are built do support ARM v8, which is 64-bit. The v7 is 32-bit. And I've run into the issue where it just would not actually launch. Little dig in, figured out that it was the architecture that was the issue, where some services will support it, some will not. And unless you're planning to do your own build and all of that, so I actually tried to dig into it a little bit more.
Sounds like a rabbit hole.
Yes, it was. It certainly was.
Oh. Yeah, all this stuff is pretty easy so long as you stay mainstream on architecture, what everyone else is doing. But as soon as you want to do a slight minor variation, the scope explodes.
Yeah, I'm at a point where I'm actually going to upgrade to the Raspberry 4s.
Mm.
Not that let us forget about doing all of that right now. But I did learn something, so
all right.
That helped, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Cool. Any other questions before we get to a demo? John, do you want to get your demo set up and let me know when you're ready to do that VS Code demo?
I'm ready to roll.
You ready to roll? Okay, let's do it. I'm going to hand over controls. Go ahead. Okay, so just a quick introduction to everyone here. So John's been a longtime member of SweetOps. He's hardcore on Terraform and developer hacks and productivity. He gave a demo last week that was pretty interesting if you haven't checked it out. That was on using Terraform Cloud and the new triggers that are available in Terraform Cloud. So having him back on today, he's going to show a cool little hack on how you can do multi-line editing, which isn't something I'd seen it before and I kind of forgot about it. And it's something like you almost don't think, I don't need that. But when you see it, you'll see that you need it and want it.
Yeah, and I actually did as a quick follow-up to the HashiCorp demo last week for Run Triggers. I did talk with them today, and they are looking at doing a few UI enhancements. As noted, it is a beta right now, so it's not meant for production use, but we did talk about some use cases and some potential UI improvements and things like that, but they are definitely excited about the feature. So
that's cool.
Hopefully we see some stuff going on there. But as far as multi-line editing, so I'm pretty big on efficiency. And I hate wasting time. And so I was managing a group of developers, and I would always be frustrated watching them edit something, because I tell them, you know, hey, all right, if we're doing Terraform, let's say, for instance, to keep it relevant, hey, go ahead and put these outputs in. Let's do an output for, you know, let's say all of the available options here. Let's do an output for those. And, you know, it would basically go something like this, right? Output, you know, something, output. If I could typing is hard, something else. And so you're just going through and slowly typing all of these outputs, which are all basically, let's say, outputs from the Terraform documentation. And so, you know, I started showing them these little performance tweaks and performance hacks to kind of improve on that speed. And so what I'll do here is actually take all of these arguments for EC2. Let's say if we were wrapping an EC2 instance and we wanted to provide all of these outputs. And this is generally in the case of, this is right now in the case of Terraform, but it could be anything. So we have a couple sections here, notes we don't really care about. So I'm just going to highlight the note, the colon, and the space, and use Command D to actually get rid of those. So now we're basically dealing with just outputs. Now, the key to multi-line editing is to find something that's common. So the shortcut by default in Visual Studio Code, your shortcuts may be different. To do a single multi-line selection is Command D. And so if I just use Command D on the A, it's going to go through and select every A. If I use Command Shift L, it's going to select every A in the document that I'm currently editing. So it's very important to find something that's unique. If I just do a dash, you can see here like EBS dash optimized, single tenant, EBS backed. That's not really going to give me what I'm looking for. And what I'm really looking for is to take the left side of this as the label and the right side as the description. And so I can kind of get a little better by selecting the space around the dashes, but then I still end up getting, because normally they do just optional, but in this case they did optional dash. So it kind of catches this one as a little bit off. So when you can't find something that's unique across all of them, one thing that every document has is line breaks. And so if you have basically everything on a single line, you can find all the line breaks and just use that. And in this case, I'm going to actually get rid of, you know, these empty line breaks here. So we can just have a clean structure. And so if I basically go to the end of the line, shift right arrow, command shift L, and then go back with my left key, I'm basically editing every single line now. I'm just at the end of all the lines. Right. So now I can move around and operate as if I'm on a single line, but I'm editing every line. So if I'm doing an input here, I can just type as I normally would. And at this point, I'm inputting all, I don't remember how many variables it was, but all 30 or 40 variables here. And now I have all of my descriptions filled out. So the other thing we can do is we know that for, let's say all of these optionals, we don't want to have that in the documentation because we're going to automatically output that. We can just highlight all of the optionals. Command Shift L, delete it, and then we can give it some default value as well. And so the key is actually just moving around with Command to go to front or back of line, Option to go by word as opposed to going by individual characters. Because if you see line 6 here, I'm here on start, but I hit Option right arrow the same amount of times, but here, I'm in a different position because the length of the description changes. So if I need to get to the beginning or to the end, I need to use my command keys in order to more quickly get to that space. But this is a very quick way, as you can see, even with all the talking, I've been able to add in all of these values pretty quickly, edit them, get them in a massage place. And now I can actually go in and tweak anything that I need to tweak. There are times like this where you're not going to have as clean of a set of data, I guess you could say. So you may have to come in and make some manual adjustments or something like that just to get this cleaned up. But that's it. Any questions around that? I'm happy to answer, but I just found as being something very important when I started creating modules, and especially when I needed to output a whole bunch of outputs or have a whole bunch of inputs in that position.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. I've had that problem with outputs, especially when you're writing modules and you want to basically proxy all the outputs from some upstream resource back out in your module. I think this would save a lot of time. Any questions, guys?
So
that was good.
I've seen this pretty common trend. Like, if you want to output multiple attributes of a single resource, people define them individually. And something I started doing was just outputting the entire resource itself, letting the end user choose from that map what they kind of want to interact with. So is that a bad practice? I know I haven't really seen it in public modules, but if I create a VPC, I pretty much just output the entire VPC resource, and then you can access it with dot notation just like you would the actual resource.
Yeah, so you're on a Terraform 012?
Correct.
Right, so this was not something we could do in 11. And so you had to output every single one of these. I switched also to doing a little bit more of just return the resource. It's a lot better, or it's a lot easier to manage and maintain on that front. But there are some cases where you may want to adjust those things. Like if you have a case where you need to do, let's say, I don't know, module. Let's say you have, an AWS instance and you have multiple of those, something like that. You may not want to output that as an ID, and you may be using count just to hide it. Mm. So this is where you kind of get into that place of doing these sort of things to kind of bring them into, you know, one output. So I think there are some cases where you may want to do some of these custom outputs. But yes, in general, I do like that you can return everything user decide.
Got it. Thanks.
I have an unrelated question. So does anyone know how can we do count.index when we are doing multiple resources with for loop?
There's actually a few ways with the for loop. It kind of depends on your scenario, but there's a few different approaches. And I think actually their documentation is generally pretty good here on that. Let me see if I can find it real quick. I always go to a few different spots here. Might be under expressions. Finding it is always difficult for me here. Does anybody remember where it is?
It says for underscore each. I think that's how you do the for loop. Yeah. So my question here is, you know, why I want to use for each is, you know, when you are using count and then you move the things, you know, maybe move the index of item on a list or maybe remove some items, count actually messes up the whole sequence. So if you're using for each, it creates, you know, a resource for each item separately. So it's not kind of, you know, a set of the things or maybe list of the things. Now, but I still want to utilize the index of the item that, you know, say, for example, if there is an array or list which has 5 items in it, I want to iterate on each of the index like 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. So I know we were able to do it with the count. I was not able to find a way to do that similar kind of stuff for each.
Yeah. The for each returns a map. So what you could do is, I think that use the values function to just access, and it basically that will return a list of the values and kind of strip out the keys. And then from there, you could call them by index.
Right. Okay, I'll test that out.
Yeah, this page here actually goes through, there was a place where they actually kind of gave a pretty solid breakdown. Yeah, right here. And I'll link to this in the chat. But it's a pretty solid breakdown of when and why you could want to use one over the other. And it kind of shows you like when to use count, you know, why you want to use count. In this case, it's something that is kind of case by case, right? Like, you can use count for certain things, but then there are certain things you may want to use, a for each loop for. So I would say it's case by case. It really depends. But I do agree with Noah in that sense.
I think everybody's used to count from 0, 1, 1. Yep. So a lot of the times when you're transitioning, you want to use for each, but then other resource references, the original ones, so you kind of get this mismatch. So where possible, I've been trying to convert from count to for each and use the keys instead of the indices. So I think it's just the problem occurs when you had previous code from 0, 1, 1, where you already have all the logic with count in place, and then switching it over is just an extra pain.
Right.
Yeah, so for that, you need to do a lot of tfstatmv, which will, you know, move those resources and make the state file, you know, graceful. I have another question. Eric, maybe you can answer since you have created a lot of modules. So I was working on one project for, you know, setting up the priorities of the rules in an ALB. Now, the priorities are dynamic. So if we have an ALB rule which deletes or maybe destroys and recreates it, the next rule takes the priority of that, and then it actually messes up the whole thing. So were you able to find a workaround for that? Or have you come across that kind of scenario?
I would have to defer that question to Andre, who's been doing more of the low-level Terraform stuff on like the ALB modules and things like that. Also, we are doing a lot more 99% of what we do as a company is on Kubernetes, and therefore like the ALB rules is not something we deal with. We just use ingresses. I do know that some of the stuff got a lot easier with 0.12 and passing maps around, but I can't give you a helpful answer right now. If you ping Andre on in the Terraform channel, at AKNYSH, he'll probably be able to answer that.
All right, thanks.
All right, I'm curious. I missed the question, but what was the question about the?
Yeah, John would probably know the answer.
Yeah, so the question is for, you know, setting up the priorities of the rules in a application load balancer. So when you have defined priorities for, you know, ALB listener rule, Terraform resource, and then if there is an instance where that rule gets recreated, gets false destroyed, if you're changing something, the next rule takes the priority of it. And then the whole sequence gets messed up. So I was just looking to get a, you know, freeze the way where, you know, things remain as it is, if at all, you know, if there is a requirement of recreating that listener rule, and next rule doesn't get the priority back.
Yeah, so you actually can control that priority on the configuration. So there's a priority.
I'm using that. However, if there is an instance where, you know, by chance, if that listener rule requires to get recreated by, you know, changing some setting which requires resource to get false destroyed,
yep.
The default behavior of ALB is, you know, if a listener rule is deleted, it actually changes the priority of all the rules which are coming next to that. So if you are, say, for example, a listener rule with a priority of number 5, mm-hmm. Gets recreated, all the rules after number 5 will be, you know, shifted one step above. Like 6 will become 5, 7 will become 6, and 8 will become 7.
Actually, I haven't seen that, but that may be because I always use factors of 10. So I don't put them one by one. I'll do like 1, 10, 20, up to whatever.
But
that may be why I haven't seen that actually. But in all the priorities we set, I never seen them reset. Once Terraform applied again, they were good to go.
Yeah, apply is good, but if at all there is an instance where the resource gets recreated, that's where it starts freaking out. So you know, there is as you know, there is a limit of number of rules that you can have and have on ALB. Mm-hmm. And I was dealing with a really legacy application, a really old application, which required us to, you know, add a lot more LB rules. And this is where I actually was able to, you know, replicate this issue.
Interesting.
When, how are you, first of all, are you using, you wouldn't happen to be using the Cloud Posse AWS ALB Ingress module, are you?
Ingress, no. It's just, you know, a simple... It works on ECS, not on Kubernetes.
Well, yeah. So this is a little bit of the confusing thing. So what we did when we were designing our our ECS modules and our modules for ALB, we had the opinion of making them feel like the Kubernetes interface for Ingress. So we created a module called Terraform AWS ALB Ingress, which is which defines a rule so that it works similar to defining an ingress in Kubernetes, even though you're defining a rule for an ALB and using ES, for example. So when you do it this way, and you're defining a module explicitly for each rule, it's been working for us, but I can't say, just like what John said, if we've encountered this thing where the priorities get renumbered or something like that. It hasn't been reported yet to us. But the different, what I wanted to make sure was that you weren't using something like a count together with defining your rules.
So, you know, we do have some dynamic paths, which also involves, you know, this was also again a reference to the question that I asked prior to that by using for each and count.
That makes sense.
So you actually remove an element from the list and then it starts freaking out.
I think that the problem therefore you have is probably more related to the module or the way you're doing the Terraform maybe than some fundamental limitation of like ALB resources themselves. Yeah,
because we actually hit an issue where sometimes if we have to recreate a target group, like if you change the name, switching from one of the Cloud Posse modules, there was like a fundamental name change of target groups. And so to delete, sometimes they don't delete properly. They kind of hold on, they're in use, so you can't delete the target group that's in use. So we did a lot of manually deleting. Warren just did this last week, actually. So we did a lot of manual deleting, and I never saw priorities change. All the priorities were stayed in line.
Yeah, so target group is okay, but priorities only change if you, you know, change the path or something, like condition or something, where that's where the, you know, the listener rule gets recreated.
Yeah, but once you give it a priority number, it should stay there. I would.
Yeah, but I want to. I still want to, you know, fix the priorities for, because those rules are dynamic. So if you add a path which is coming from a variable, which is a list, then you know you add another path, then it will again spin up a new listener rule to the next priority, and then it becomes a headache to maintain.
Yeah, so maybe look at adjusting your list and utilize a map or something to where you can define like a set priority for those. That way, when you loop over it, it's a set priority every single time, no matter if you move it up and down in your list or if something else gets deleted.
Makes sense. Make it explicit.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Are there any other questions?
So I have a question. So my use case is like, I kind of want to generate a report like based on like underutilized EC2 instance and overutilized EC2 instance, and automated to send the reports to an email. Like if the instances are running less than 10%, I would like to see the instance list. And if it's more than 80%, I would like to see the list of instances. So I just looking for ideas to achieve this.
Gotcha. So I bet somebody here might have a suggestion for that. We work with mostly just infrastructure managed under Kubernetes, and so we're not really concerned about any one instance in and of itself from a reporting perspective. But yeah, anybody familiar with some tools to generate the reports that he's looking for?
AWS has the cost and usage report that's kind of built in. I don't know about the request of emailing, but I know that's in there.
Mm-hmm. Or you could turn it into SNS.
Yeah, could probably do that for sure. Yeah. I'll put the link in the chat.
And it's probably the utilization for some period of time, right? So.
Yeah, some period of time, like a week, few days, like that.
Yeah. All right. Well, if yeah, something else comes to mind, just feel free to share that either in the chat here or in office hours. There are also, I mean, yeah, so like on talk of like there's the trusted advisor stuff, which will make similar kinds of recommendations. And then there's SaaS services as well. But I don't think that was necessarily the answer you're looking for.
There's a SaaS for everything.
Right. Out-SaaS'd. Totally out-SaaS'd. Cool. Yeah, any other questions?
Other questions.
All right. Well, let's cover a couple of the talking points here that came up. I'm not sure. I know I definitely recognize a few people on the call here using Kubernetes a lot. So I think this Goldilocks is will be a welcome utility that was shared. Goldilocks, I only learned of it today. What I thought was interesting was how they went about implementing it. So behind the scenes, it's using the vertical pod autoscaler in just notification mode or in like debug mode, so that it's not actually autoscaling your pods, but it's making the recommendations for what your pods should be. And then they slap a UI on that, and here's what you get. So I think why this is really valuable is, well, if you saw the viral video that went around this past week about how they dubbed that famous video with Hitler reprimanding his troops. Well, they took that and they said they parodied this situation about running Kubernetes in production without setting your limits, and how asinine that is. Well, it's unfortunately a pretty common thing. So helping your developers and your teams know what the appropriate limits for your pods should be is an important thing. So this here is a tool to make that easier.
Yeah, just building that, like when I joined this team, that was an issue as well. I guess at the same time, Kubernetes was, we're getting to Kubernetes in an early stage, so the experience was not there. And we would find that over time, we'd have a lot of evictions going on within the cluster. Because we didn't have any resource limits set aside for these things. So we actually had to go through the process of pretty much evaluating, which is why this kind of tool, I didn't know existed until I asked that question as well, came about, which would really help. Because we actually implemented Datadog to help us give us some kind of measurement in terms of what was going on, and then starting to send like more utilization traffic to see what our peak points are, to kind of determine that. So I figured that everyone had their own methodology to determine what those resource limits were going to be as well. And I saw even the question before this was posted, some equation in terms of how to determine the ratio of limits, and it was just a whole thing. So I'm actually looking forward to actually using this tool to kind of make that determination as well.
Yeah, I think that's basically been what everyone's been doing, is looking at either their Prometheus or looking at their Grafanas or Datadogs and determining those limits, which is fine. What I like about this is that it just dumbs it down to the point here. Literally copy and paste this and stick it in your Helm values, or if you're doing raw resources, stick it in there and you'll be good to go. There are a couple other tools I've seen specific. So the concept here is right-sizing. So right-sizing your pods. So if you're using Ocean by spotinst.com, so Ocean is a controller for Kubernetes to right-size your nodes. Ocean also provides a dashboard to help you right-size the workloads, the pods in there. So that's one option. The other option is if you have KubeCost. KubeCost is a open source or open core kind of product that will make recommendations like similar to Trusted Advisor, but for Kubernetes, and it'll also give suggestions on how to right size your pods. All right. Then let's see, what was the other thing I had here? So I asked for some feedback. Got a lot of great conversations going on in the general channel, if you check yesterday, related to this. We're working on an engagement right now, and the customer asks, so what kind of apps are should we tackle first for migration to Kubernetes? And it's a common question that we cover in all our engagements. So I thought I'd just kind of whip it up and distill it to the characteristics of the ideal app. I like to say that pretty much anything can run on Kubernetes. The constructs are there, the primitives are there to so to say, lift and shift traditional workloads. But traditional workloads aren't going to get the maximum benefit inside of Kubernetes, like the ability to work with the horizontal pod autoscalers and use deployments and stuff like that. So here are some considerations that I jotted down using 12-factor as the pattern. So the 12-factor app, I'm sure if you've been working with this stuff for some time, you've seen those recommendations before. It looks something like this. In my mind, they're slightly dated in terms of the terms as it relates to Kubernetes. And it's a little bit academic. So if we look at the explanations for how these things should work. So, okay, so first of all, this is very opinionated and just talking about like specifically Ruby and using gem files. But let's generalize that, right? So the concept here, if we're talking about Kubernetes, is we still want to pin our software releases, but we also can just generalize that and say, distribute a Docker file that has all your dependencies therein and pin to releases. So that's kind of what I've done here in this link here. And it's a checklist. So if you can go through and identify an app that checks off all of these, it's a perfect candidate to tackle first in terms of migration. I like to say, move your easiest apps first. Don't move your hardest apps and until you build all that operational competency. So working down on the list here, let's see here. So this is a little bit opinionated, but we really feel like poly repos are so much easier to work with and deploy with the pipelines to Kubernetes. So that's why we recommend working with that. Using obviously Git-based workflows. So this is that you have a pull request review approval process so that code, you're not editing master, believe it or not, some companies do that. We don't want that. And then automated tests. So if we want to have any type of continuous part of our delivery, well, we need to make sure we have foundational tests in there. Moving on then to dependencies, that things that your services depend on are explicit. One thing that we see far too often are hard-coded host names in source code. That's really bad. We got to get those extracted either into a configuration file or ideally via environment variables. We like environment variables because those are our first class citizen Kubernetes and very easy to map later. Services being loosely coupled. This is that your services can start in any order. Your API service must be able to start even if your database isn't yet online. It's frequently an older pattern where, well, if the API can't connect to the database, well, then the API just exits and crashes. And this can create like a startup storm where your processes are constantly in a crash loop and things only start to settle once the backups kick in and your applications stop thrashing so much. Decoupling.
So would that be then be more on the development team to ensure that kind of a control? So
the idea is here that if this is not a hard requirements list, but these are like, well, oh, if this jogs a memory, yeah, that's how our application works. Then what we ask is that they change the way their application works so that it doesn't have these limitations.
So I'm actually working with a client that actually, I don't know if they got wind of your list, but it took your list and did the opposite.
Hopefully not on all the points. But
most of them.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
In fact, they're still using ColdFusion.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, stop right there.
Take me back there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so that sounds like you have a big project ahead of you, which might be changing some of the engineering norms that they have adopted over the years. We've been pretty lucky that most of the customers, like a lot of this stuff is intuitive for them, or like is stuff that they've already been practicing, but then there'll be like one or two things here or there that are news. Like the one thing that we get bit by all the time is like their application might like be talking to S3, and then their application has some custom configuration for getting the access key and the secret access key. So that precludes us using all the awesomeness of the AWS SDK for automatically discovering these things if you set up the environment correctly. So having them undo those kinds of things, it would be another use case. My main point with kind of going over these things would be to jog any reactions, like if anybody is totally against some of these recommendations or if any of these are controversial or anything that I missed. So please chime in if that's the case. Backing services, ideal services are totally stateless. That is that you can kind of offload the durability to some other service that's hopefully not running inside of Kubernetes, of course. It's not saying that Kubernetes is not good for running stateful services. It is. It's just, it's a lot larger scope, right? Managing a database inside of Kubernetes versus using RDS. Let's see here. Anything else to call out? This is a common thing. Applications don't properly handle SIGTERM. So your apps want to exit when they receive that gracefully. Some apps just ignore it, and then what happens is Kubernetes waits until the grace period expires and then just, SIG kills your process the hard way, which we want to avoid. Sticky sessions, let's get rid of those.
Oh, yes.
And this one here. This is a surprisingly common, actually. So we're all for feature flags. We recommend feature flags all the time. They can be implemented in different ways. Using environment variables is an awesome way of doing it. But making your feature flags based on the environment or the stage you're operating in is a shortcut, but not really an effective use of feature flags, because you can't test that function. You shouldn't be changing the environment in staging to test the feature. You should be enabling or disabling the feature itself. So that's a pet peeve of mine here. And related to that is also not using hard-coded host names, even configurable host names in your applications. That's, if you're running Kubernetes, that's really the job of your ingress, and your application should not be aware.
Care. Yeah. Or even care.
Or even care, exactly, yeah. Alex Siegman posts in chat here. So you mentioned on port binding that you should listen on non-privileged ports, but what's the harm of having your application map port 80, for example, if it's a web API? So The harm is really that, well, the only way you can listen on port 80 and you're inside your app is if your app starts as root. And then that's contradictory to saying that you should run non-privileged processes. So things, you should not be running your processes as root. Yes, your container can be as root. Your application can start up as root. It can bind to the port as root, and then it can drop permissions. But so often things do not drop permissions, and then you'll have all these services unnecessarily running as root. And just for the vanity of the service running on a classical port like 80, is it really required? And that's not the case. So exactly. So Alex says, aha, so that's why you should run as non-root inside of the container. Exactly. So that's our point there.
Yeah, I think a lot of times what I see is like when the Docker file is actually created, because it just works as root, no one actually goes back and say, all right, let me have it run as a non-privileged user so it actually works in that way. And, you know, they may hit upon like the roadblocks in terms of getting it to work properly, not mainly because of a lack of knowledge as to how to do that. And they just say, hey, you know, it works, let's just leave it. And then it just goes out there and then something happens.
And then that pattern gets replicated, right? Because somebody says, oh, how do I deploy our new service? Oh, just go look at this other repo. And then they copy, paste that stuff over, and then it replicates and exactly. Quickly becomes the norm in the organization.
Yeah.
So logs, this is a nice to have. I mean, it's not a hard requirement, but it really does make once you have all your logs centralized in a system like Kibana or any of the modern log systems like Sumo Logic or Splunk, is that if your logs are structured, you're going to be able to develop much more powerful reports. And most, if you're using any language or framework, a lot of them support changing the way your events are emitted these days. So no reason not to. The most important thing is just don't write to disk, because we don't want to have to start doing log rotation. And you can, if quotas aren't set up correctly, which they usually aren't, you can fill up the disk on the host OS. So let's not do that.